who had worked for Mrs. Morell for more than 30 years, and for her mother before that, was permitted to drive her smaller car, but not the Mercedes limousine. No one but Big Emma was permitted to drive that one. It was her exclusive domain. One recent noontime, she drove downtown to the headquarters of the Savannah Bank on Johnson Square to sign some papers. Before setting out, she had called ahead and told the bank's trust officer to meet her with the papers by the curb in front of the bank. She was in a hurry, she said, and didn't want to be kept waiting. 20 minutes later, Big Emma turned the corner into Johnson Square, the massive German shepherd sitting at her side and the old uniformed chauffeur cowering in back. She drew up to the trust officer, but never quite came to a complete stop. The trust officer trotted alongside the limousine, handing papers through the window, pleading, "For heaven's sake, Emma, stop the car!" Big Emma glided along at 8 or 10 miles an hour, scribbling on papers and handing them back, one by one. They were halfway around Johnson Square when she handed the last document back to the trust officer, rolled up the window, and sped off. Of all the tales told about Big Emma Morell, the one most often repeated was her vociferous opposition to the marriage of her daughter to Lee Adler, on the grounds that he was Jewish. Big Emma was vehement. She bellowed. She orated. She pounded on tables. She would not listen to arguments that John Morell, her own husband and Little Emma's father, was one quarter Jewish himself. When Little Emma stood her ground, Big Emma turned sullen. She refused to take her daughter to New York to buy her a wedding dress. Lee Adler's mother took her instead. At the wedding rehearsal, Big Emma stood as far away as she could from the Adlers. Then, at the reception after the wedding, she refused to let the Adlers join the receiving line. She froze them out. That episode was still remembered today, 25 years later. And it was the reason why the man standing outside Cynthia Collins's house with his hands in his pockets compared Emma Adler favorably with her mother. At 7:30 on the dot, a beaming Cynthia Collins opened her front door, wearing a long black dress and carrying a black lace fan. "Come in, everybody," she said cheerfully. Her guests filed in and wandered among the card tables set up in the living room and the dining room. As soon as they found their place cards, they sat down, and within minutes, the tables were full. Conversation subsided to a muted hum, and the sound of shuffling cards swept through the house like autumn leaves blowing across a lawn. Not being a bridge player, I joined two other non-playing guests, a man and a woman, in a small library off the living room. The man had long white hair and a benevolent smile fixed on his face. He was, I gathered, a much-respected figure in the community. The woman was perhaps 40 and smoked a pale blue cigarette. Across the room, two maids in crisp black-and-white uniforms stood beside pitchers of Manhattans, martinis, sherry-and-tea punch, and water. Cynthia Collins came into the room, flush-faced and smiling. "Well, the first rubbers started on time, so I can catch my breath for a moment. I hope you all didn't wait outside very long in that awful heat." "The curbside chatter was all about Lee and Emma," said the woman with the blue cigarette. "You know, I thought about Lee this afternoon," said Cynthia, "while I was writing out place cards for tonight. You still have to be careful who you put with whom, because of the uproar over the Hyatt. Even now. We have Lee to thank for that, of course." "Don't remind me," said the other woman. "It was dreadful. At the height of it, you couldn't go to cocktail parties. You couldn't do anything. People got into such awful arguments, it was easier to just stay home." "My sister-in-law and I are not on speaking terms to this day," the white-haired man said solemnly. "However, I must say I'm rather grateful for that." Cynthia Collins glanced discreetly at her watch. "Water," she whispered to the maids. "It's always all or nothing with Lee," said the other woman. "If he can't have his way, then nobody can. He follows a scorched earth policy."
"And he does shout," said Cynthia.
"My dear, he does more than that. Don't you remember that business with the gun?"
"What gun?"
"Lee had a disagreement with one of the other members of the board of the National Trust and pulled a pistol on him at a formal dinner. I think it was in Chicago, a couple of years ago."
"Oh, that's right," said Cynthia. "I'd forgotten. But it was a toy gun, as I remember. The way I heard it, Lee didn't actually accost the man. He presented the gun to him and suggested he shoot himself with it."
"Maybe that was it," said the other woman.
People were aghast. There had apparently been some kind of shooting in the poor man's family not long before, which made it positively ghoulish. Jimmy Biddle was president of the National Trust at the time. He stepped in and told Lee he was completely out of line and to take his seat. It was all very tasteless and embarrassing. I guess that's what I was thinking about.
The white-haired man sat back in his chair, casting his eyes from one woman to the other, like a spectator at a tennis match. Cynthia turned to me.
"We must sound very catty to you," she said, "but years ago Lee was our hero. We were his disciples. Because of Lee, we all moved downtown when it was still slummy and not very safe. It was exciting. The Hartridges even bought a townhouse next door to a whorehouse on Jones Street. In those days, Lee was pursuing something magnificent. He was an idealist and a purist. He was saving downtown. Of course, he didn't actually move downtown until much later. He and Emma stayed out in Ardsley Park where it was safe, while the rest of us moved downtown and pioneered. The Cunninghams, the Kreitzes, the Brannans, the Rangaseys, the Dunns, the whole board of historic Savannah lived downtown, except for Lee. The Adlers didn't stick their necks out. They talked one game and played another. And now all he seems to care about are those damned awards and cozying up to people like Prince Charles."
"What happened?" I asked.
"He became impossible to deal with," said Cynthia. "He was never much for democratic procedures in the first place. When he was president of Historic Savannah, he did just as he pleased and rarely consulted the board beforehand. It all came to a head with the Hyatt. We were all against the hotel. It was originally supposed to be a 15-story building that would have towered over City Hall. The whole board voted against it, including Lee. Then the board took a second vote on whether to make their opposition public. They voted to wait until they'd had a chance to talk with the developers. But Lee was adamant. He wanted a public confrontation right away. The board held firm. Since he didn't get his way, Lee decided to launch his own attack against the hotel. First, he withdrew his annual contribution to Historic Savannah, $7,000, which he'd earmarked for the director's salary. That was typical of Lee, by the way, to specify some high-profile use for his donation, instead of giving money with no strings attached the way other people did. That's Lee, the one-man show. If he can't run it, he doesn't want any part of it. You can hardly blame the board for throwing him out of Historic Savannah."
My ears pricked up at this.
"I thought it was Lee Adler who broke with Historic Savannah," I said. "Not the other way around."
"Lee was definitely voted out," said Cynthia. "And what made it so poignant was that the people who voted him out were his friends and disciples. And the vote was unanimous. The minutes of that meeting have disappeared from the files, mysteriously, but you can ask Walter Hartridge about it. He was president at the time. He and Connie are playing bridge in the next room."
"The saddest part," said the other woman, "was that things would have worked out a whole lot better if Lee hadn't stirred things up on his own. At one point, the developers offered a compromise that was better than what we finally ended up with."
"I had the impression,"
I said, thinking back to what Adler had told me, that Adler quit Historic Savannah over a disagreement concerning housing for blacks in the Victorian district. At this, the other woman stubbed out her blue cigarette.
I can't take it anymore, she said. It makes me so damn mad. Cynthia, I don't care where we are on the schedule. I'm ready for a drink.
She went over to the table and poured herself a Manhattan.
Lee Adler did not quit Historic Savannah. He was thrown out, said the woman. That was in 1969. He didn't start Savannah Landmark in the Victorian district until something like 5 years later. One had nothing to do with the other. Savannah Landmark is nothing but an ego trip. Of course, he pretends it's more noble than that. He portrays himself as a preservationist with a social conscience. He says he's creating a racially mixed neighborhood. Bull. He's creating a new black ghetto. It's not true integration. It's segregation all over again.
Lee was devastated when he was forced out of Historic Savannah. He'd been president for 6 years. It was his life. He had to show Historic Savannah that he could do it on his own somehow, and he seized on the Victorian district as his vehicle. He hit on a scheme to use government money to buy and restore historic houses for subsidized tenants. It had nothing to do with pious social aims. It was just a way of financing a preservation project with himself at the head of it. He says he's restoring houses without displacing long-time residents. As if the Victorian district was historically black or even mixed. Well, it wasn't. Until the middle of the 1960s, it was a white, middle-class neighborhood. If Lee hadn't been so damn stuck on himself, the private marketplace would have taken care of the Victorian district. And believe me, blacks would still have been well represented downtown. Public housing is needed, I'll grant you, but the Victorian district is about the worst place for it. The woman explained that the houses in the Victorian district were mostly wood-frame dwellings, which meant that the fire insurance was very high and that the houses had to be repainted every 3 years or so because the intense humidity made the paint peel quickly. Costs like that are indefensible in publicly subsidized housing, she said. And Lee's not doing fine restoration work at all, she went on. He's gutting the houses and ripping out nice little Victorian touches like stamped tin ceilings. And he's not keeping the houses in good shape. Take a look at them. All of them, not just the few he likes to show off. The paint is peeling, the porch railings are broken. 2 or 3 years after they've been restored, his houses blend right in with the unrestored houses next to them. Through the door, I could see the maids moving from table to table, collecting the empty water glasses. And if I may be so bold, the woman went on, what's so damned awful about gentrification? Gentrification was fine with Lee when it suited him in the historic district. He's stopped gentrification, all right, and he's also killed real estate values in the Victorian district. It's a buyer's market, but there are no buyers. In the name of preservation, Lee Adler has stopped preservation cold. But Adler had told me, I said, that restoration in the Victorian district had encouraged private investment there. That's a flat-out lie, and no one knows it better than Lee Adler. One of his sons bought a house on Waldberg Street and restored it magnificently. But when the time came to sell it, there weren't any takers. His asking price was $135,000. Now it's down to $97,000, and still nobody wants it because it's smack dab in the middle of a black slum. Outside Savannah, said Cynthia, people think the Victorian district has been a great success, because that's what Lee tells them. They all swallow his line. Prince Charles is just the latest in a long line of chumps. What's really irritating, the other woman said, is the way the Adlers have set themselves up as moral arbiters. It makes me want to scream. I'm tired of Lee's noble pretensions, and I'm sick of Emma's Eleanor Roosevelt act. What have we done to deserve it?
Plenty,
said the white-haired man. The two women looked at the man in surprise. He was still smiling his benevolent smile.
"Lee is a prominent member of Savannah Society, is he not?"
the man asked gently.
"He belongs to the Cotillion Club, which sponsors the debutante balls. He's one of the 15 distinguished gentlemen in the Madeira Club, where he and the others deliver learned papers over Epicurean dinners and fine Madeira wines. He belongs to the Chatham Club, where he can go for drinks and dinner and look out over the rooftops of the historic district he's been so instrumental in preserving."
The two women nodded cautiously, unsure what the man was driving at.
"He plays golf at the Savannah Golf Club," the man went on. "So Lee Adler is one of Savannah's elite.
At least you'd think so.
But he isn't really, is he? In Savannah, we have our little way of drawing the line, of saying, you shall come this far and no farther. You are not really one of us. We have the Oglethorpe Club as our way of saying this. And we have the Yacht Club."
The man spoke softly, like a kindly professor.
"Lee Adler is Jewish. A great many of his good friends belong to the Oglethorpe Club and the Yacht Club, but he does not."
"But the Oglethorpe Club does admit Jews," said the woman. "Bob Minus is a member."
"Yes, Bob Minus is one of the oldest members of the Oglethorpe Club, and he's very well liked. He's also the great-great-grandson of the first white child born in Georgia, which makes him a living relic of Georgia history. He's Jewish, but not overly Jewish. Both of his wives have been Christians, and so have most of his friends, and his children have been raised as Episcopalians.
Bob Minus gives good value as a member of the Oglethorpe Club. Apart from being delightful company, he enables us to say, as you have just said, but we do have Jews in the Oglethorpe Club."
The man folded his arms and looked at each of us in turn, as if to assure himself that his point had been received.
"On the other hand," he went on, "there's Lee Adler. Cold-shouldered by the Oglethorpe Club and tossed out of historic Savannah. What is he to do? He must do something brilliant, something absolutely ingenious. In my opinion, he succeeded beyond his wildest dreams. Through his work in the Victorian district, he has not only made a comeback as a historic preservationist, he has wrapped himself in a morally unassailable issue: housing for poor blacks. If you oppose him, you look like a racist. Lee's Savannah Landmark Project may be unrealistically expensive. His restorations may be shoddy. He may have depressed real estate values in the Victorian district. He may have created a new black ghetto. He may even be in it, as some people suspect, for the money and the recognition. But nobody can stand up and say so, and that's why it's so brilliant. Lee Adler has achieved his objective. He has regained his position as one of America's leading preservationists, and in the process, he has rubbed our noses in the issue of race."
"I don't believe he's sincere about blacks," said the woman with the blue cigarette. "Not one of the clubs Lee belongs to, at least none you've just mentioned, has ever had any black members."
"True," said the man. "And for that matter, I suspect the blacks themselves may wonder if Lee and Emma are sincere. For instance, if you read Emma's newspaper article about Prince Charles carefully, you'll see something very curious. Emma twits the members of the Washington Press Corps who were present at the meeting for being interested only in frivolous speculation about Prince Charles rather than in the issue of housing. But then she carries on at great length about the sweet black cook she took with her, and how the cook had made a basket out of pine needles for the prince, and that she had worried for weeks about how to present it to him. Emma didn't find fault with the cook's somewhat childlike preoccupation with her basket, though the basket didn't have anything to do with the issue of housing either. Emma appears to have a double standard, one for educated journalists and one for simple black cooks. From this,
One might draw the conclusion that Emma has a patronizing attitude towards blacks.
A satisfied smile spread across the face of the woman with the blue cigarette.
She said. I think the blacks know where they stand with Lee and Emma, the man went on. They also know, probably, that no one here tonight has renovated 300 apartments for poor blacks or taken their black cook to meet Prince Charles. The blacks know that the Adlers are doing something for them, whatever their motives may be. And in return, the blacks are doing something for the Adlers.
What on earth are they doing for the Adlers? Asked the woman.
They're giving the Adlers their vote, he said. In the last election, you may remember that Lee and Emma supported Spencer Lawton for district attorney against Bubsy Ryan. The Adlers were among the largest contributors to Lawton's campaign. One can assume Lee passed the word to the black ministers that he was supporting Lawton. Presto, the black ministerial alliance, which had backed Ryan in the past, switched over to Lawton. Lawton won the black vote, and the black vote gave him his margin of victory. So whether he planned it or not, Lee Adler emerged from his crisis with a black power base, and with the district attorney grateful to him for his help. This makes Lee a political power. It makes it impolitic for any city official to oppose Lee in any of his little housing ventures.
The man raised his eyebrows as if to say, I rest my case.
Well, I do see your point, the woman said dryly.
The man then looked over at Cynthia Collins, but at that moment Mrs. Collins was stealing a glance at her watch. A flicker of concern crossed her brow. She caught the eye of the maid by the door.
Pass napkins, she whispered.
Chapter 11. Newsflash. At this point in my experiment in bi-urban living, I found myself spending more time in Savannah than New York. The weather alone would have been reason enough for the tilt. By late April, New York was still struggling to free itself from the clutches of winter, and Savannah was well into the unfolding pageantry of a warm and leisurely spring. Camellias, jonquils, and paper whites had bloomed in December and January. Wisteria and redbuds had followed, and then, in mid-March, the azaleas burst forth in gigantic pillows of white, red, and vermilion. White dogwood blossoms floated like clouds of confectioner's sugar above the azaleas. The scent of honeysuckle, Confederate jasmine, and the first magnolia blossoms were already beginning to perfume the air. Who needed the chill of New York? So I lingered in Savannah. Its hushed and somnolent streets became my streets of choice. I stayed put, just as Savannians did. Savannians often talked about other places, as if they traveled a lot, but usually it was just talk. Savannians liked to talk about Charleston most of all, especially in the presence of a newcomer. They would compare the two cities endlessly. Savannah was the hostess city. Charleston was the holy city, because it had a lot of churches. Savannah's streetscape was superior to Charleston's, but Charleston had finer interiors. Savannah was thoroughly English in style and temperament. Charleston had French and Spanish influences as well as English. Savannah preferred hunting, fishing, and going to parties over intellectual pursuits. In Charleston, it was the other way around. Savannah was attractive to tourists. Charleston was overrun by them. On and on. In the minds of most Americans, Savannah and Charleston were sister cities. If so, the sisters were barely on speaking terms. Savannians rarely went to Charleston, even though it was less than 2 hours away by car. But then, Savannians rarely went anywhere at all. They couldn't be bothered. They were content to remain in their isolated city under self-imposed house arrest. There were exceptions, of course, and Chablis was one of them. Chablis took her act on the road via trailways, just as she said she would, to Augusta, Columbia, Atlanta, and Jacksonville. She came back to Savannah between swings, long enough to freshen her wardrobe and avail herself of Dr. Myra Bishop's female hormone shots. When she was finished at Dr. Bishop's, she invariably called me up or threw pebbles at my window, and I'd come down and drive her home. She came to look upon these rides as a ceremonial aspect of her sexual journey. The estrogen would be working its magic inside her, transforming the tomboy into a graceful empress, even as we drove through the streets of Savannah. One Saturday morning in early May, I was preparing to drive out to Fort Jackson to watch one of Savannah's traditional annual sporting events, the Scottish Games, when the telephone rang. It was Chablis.
"It's the bitch, honey," she said. "It's the lady. I ain't looking for a ride this time, though. I'm just checking to see if you've had a look at your morning paper yet."
"No, I haven't," I said. "Why?"
"Remember that antique dealer you told me you met? The one with the big house on Monterey Square?"
"Yes," I said.
"Didn't you tell me his name was Jim Williams?"
"Yes, I did. What about him?"
"James A. Williams?" she asked.
"Yes."
"Age 52?
"Sounds right," I said.
"Of 429 Bull Street?" "Come on, Chablis, what happened?"
"She shot somebody last night."
"What? Chablis, are you serious?"
"I wouldn't joke about a thing like that. That's what it says right here in the paper. It says James A. Williams shot Danny Lewis Hansford, 21. It happened inside Mercer House. They got a big old picture of your friend James A. Williams on the front page, but they ain't got one of the 21-year-old, damn it. And that's the one I want to see."
"Did Danny Hansford die?" I asked.
"He must have did, honey, 'cause they're charging Miss Williams with murder."
Part 2. Chapter 12. Gunplay. Under the banner headline, "Williams Charged in Slaying," the story was very brief. It said that at 3 a.m., police had been summoned to Mercer House, where they found Danny Hansford, 21, lying dead on the floor in the study, his blood pouring out onto an oriental carpet. He had been shot in the head and chest. There were two pistols at the scene. Several objects in the house had been broken. Williams had been taken into custody, charged with murder, and held on $25,000 bond. 15 minutes later, a friend of Williams had arrived at police headquarters with a paper bag containing 250 $100 bills, and Williams was released. That was all the newspaper said about the shooting. Williams was identified as an antiques dealer, a restorer of historic houses, and a giver of elegant parties at his showplace home, which Jacqueline Onassis had visited and offered to buy for $2 million. About Danny Hansford, the paper gave no information, other than his age. The next day's newspaper carried a more detailed account of the shooting. According to Williams, he had shot Danny Hansford in self-defense. He and Danny had attended a drive-in movie, he said, and returned to Mercer House after midnight. Back at the house, Hansford suddenly went wild, just as Williams said he had done a month earlier. He stomped a video game, broke a chair, smashed an 18th-century English grandfather clock. Then, just as he had done before, he grabbed one of Williams' German Lugers. But this time, he didn't fire it into the floor or out into Monterey Square. This time, he aimed it directly at Williams, who was sitting behind his desk. He fired three shots. All three missed. When he pulled the trigger to fire again, the gun jammed. That was when Williams reached into his desk drawer and took out another Luger. Danny was struggling to unjam his gun when Williams shot him. Later in the week, Williams elaborated further in an interview in the weekly newspaper, the Georgia Gazette. His tone was confident, even a little defiant. "If I had not shot Danny," he said, "it would have been my obituary that was published." Williams said the movie at the drive-in had been a violent horror film. Lots of throats being slashed and that sort of thing. I told Danny we should leave and go play backgammon or chess or something, and we did. By the time Williams and Hansford arrived back at Mercer House, Danny had smoked 9 joints and consumed a half pint of whiskey. They played a video game for a while, and then a board game. At that point, Hansford launched into an emotional tirade against his mother, his girlfriend Bonnie, and his buddy George Hill. Suddenly, in a flash of anger, he stomped the video control panel. "Games," he screamed. "It's all games. That's what it's all about." Williams stood up to leave the room. Hansford grabbed him by the throat and threw him up against a door jamb. "You've been sick," he screamed. "Why don't you just go off someplace and die?" Williams wrenched himself out of Hansford's grip and went into his study, where he sat down at his desk. He heard loud crashing noises, the grandfather clock falling to the floor, glass breaking, and other sounds of destruction. Danny came into the room carrying a German Luger. "I'm leaving tomorrow," he said, "but you're leaving tonight." With that, he took aim at Williams and fired. Williams said he felt a breeze as one of the bullets passed his left arm. Then Danny's gun jammed. Williams grabbed his own gun and fired. After Danny fell, Williams put his gun down on the desk, walked around the desk, saw that Danny was dead, then went back behind the desk and called a former employee, Joe Goodman. Williams told Goodman he had just shot Hansford and to come to Mercer House right away. After that, Williams called his lawyer. Then he called the police. Williams' lawyer, the police, Joe Goodman, and Joe Goodman's girlfriend all arrived at Mercer House at the same time. Williams was standing at the open door. "I just shot him," he said. "He's in the other room." The first policeman to arrive on the scene, Corporal Michael Anderson, recognized Danny immediately. Corporal Anderson was the same policeman who had come to Mercer House a month earlier to take Danny into custody after his previous rampage. On that occasion, he had found Danny upstairs stretched across the bed, fully clothed. This time, he found him lying on a Persian carpet in William's study, with his face in a pool of blood. His right arm was outstretched above his head, his hand cupped lightly over a gun. Toward 7 a.m., the police escorted Williams to headquarters. They fingerprinted him, booked him for murder, and set bond at $25,000. Williams went to a telephone and called Joe Goodman, who was still waiting back at Mercer House.
"Joe, now listen carefully," he said. "Go upstairs to the tall cabinet outside the organ room. Stand on the chair next to it, reach up, and take down a paper sack that's sitting on top." 15 minutes later, Goodman arrived at police headquarters with a brown paper bag containing 250 $100 bills, and Williams went home. A few days later, the police announced that certain lab tests would show whether or not Danny Hansford had actually fired a pistol, as Williams had claimed. A crucial test would be the presence or absence of gunshot powder on Hansford's hands. If gunshot residue could be detected, it would mean Hansford had fired his gun before Williams killed him.
The absence of residue would mean he had not fired. Police said the results would be ready in a week or so and could make or break the case against Williams. Despite the heavy charges hanging over him, Williams went calmly about his affairs. On Wednesday, 4 days after he shot Hansford, he asked the court for permission to fly to Europe on an antiques buying trip. The judge raised his bond to $100,000 and let him go. In London, Williams stayed in his favorite suite at the Ritz and played roulette at Crockford's Club. Then he flew on to Geneva to attend a sale of Fabergé. He returned to Savannah a week later. Soon afterward, the police announced that the lab tests would be delayed because of a backlog of work at the Georgia Crime Lab in Atlanta. A month later, the police were still awaiting results. In the meantime, people in Savannah were coming to conclusions of their own without benefit of lab results. Facts about Danny Hansford were beginning to circulate, and they lent credence to Williams' claim of self-defense. Hansford had been in and out of juvenile homes and mental hospitals. He had dropped out of school in the 8th grade and had a history of violence and getting into trouble with the police. Williams himself had bailed him out of jail 9 times in the past 10 months. Skipper Dunn, a horticulturalist who had once lived in the same rooming house as Hansford, described him as a dangerous psychotic.
"He was a berserker," Dunn said. "I saw him run amok twice, breaking things, reaching for knives. It took 2 people to pin him down. You could look into his eyes and see there was no person left, only rage and violence. It was easy to see that he might try to kill someone someday."
Hansford had once torn a door off its hinges in an effort to get at his sister and beat her up. His own mother had sworn out a police warrant against him, declaring that she was afraid he would do bodily harm to her and her family. In his interview with the Georgia Gazette, Williams described Hansford as severely disturbed. He said Hansford had once told him, "I'm alone in this world. No one cares about me. I don't have anything to live for." With a strange sort of detachment, Williams saw himself as Danny Hansford's savior rather than his nemesis, much less his murderer.
"I was determined to save him from himself," he said. "He had given up on being alive."
Though Williams's view was unabashedly self-serving, it was compelling in its detail. Hansford had developed a fascination with death, he said. He would frequently go to Bonaventure Cemetery with friends and point to the grave markers and say that the small ones were for poor people and the big ones were for rich people, and that if he died in Mercer House, he would get a big one. Hansford had twice tried to commit suicide at Mercer House by taking drug overdoses. The second time, he had written a note. "If this stuff does the job, at least I'll get a decent tombstone." Williams had rushed him to the hospital both times. All of that was a matter of record. Beyond saying Danny Hansford was an employee, Williams never fully explained their relationship. But it soon became known that Hansford had been a part-time male hustler who loitered in the squares along Bull Street. Most people didn't need to have the rest of the story spelled out for them. A few of Williams's friends, however, society ladies for the most part, discovered they had been completely in the dark. Millicent Moreland, an Ardsley Park hostess and a blue blood, had known Williams for 30 years. Yet when a friend called her to say, "Jim Williams has just shot and killed his lover," she was dumbstruck for 2 reasons, not just one.
"That statement left me absolutely gasping," Mrs. Moreland said. "My friendship with Jim had been based on antiques and parties and social things. I simply wasn't aware of his other interests in life."
Most of the social set were more worldly than Mrs. Moreland.
"Oh, we knew," said John Myers. "Of course we knew.
We weren't aware of the details, naturally, because Jim exercised discretion, which was the right thing to do. But all along we'd congratulated ourselves about Jim's social success because of what it seemed to say about us. We thought it proved Savannah was cosmopolitan, that we were sophisticated enough to accept a gay man socially. Mrs. Moreland remained loyal to Williams, but there were certain things that did trouble her, apart from the shooting itself. She was perplexed by a seemingly small detail in the rush of events that happened that night.
"Joe Goodman," she said. "Who is he? I don't know him. I've never seen him in Jim's house, and yet he was the first person Jim called."
Mrs. Moreland's consternation about Joe Goodman arose from the fact that she had lived her entire life within the reassuring confines of what was known as Old Savannah. Old Savannah was a sharply circumscribed, self-contained world. The supporting roles for all of its dramas had been cast long ago. In times of crisis, one turned to the relevant figures in the community. The legal authority, the moral pillar, the social arbiter, the financial titan, the elder statesman. Old Savannah was well structured for dealing with crises. Having spent a lifetime in this comforting environment, Mrs. Moreland was surprised that in his moment of need, Jim Williams had reached out to someone completely unknown, rather than to Walter Hartridge, for instance, or Dick Richardson. It was a signal to her that something was terribly off-kilter. With so much talk centering on Jim Williams, his origins, his career, his exploits, his everything, the incident of the Nazi flag came in for a good bit of rehashing. And now a shooting with a German Luger, no less. Some people, even a few Jews like Bob Minus, dismissed the Nazi flag episode as insignificant. "It was stupid," said Minus. "Jim acted quickly, without thinking." But others were not inclined to let Williams off so easily. "I'm sure he doesn't actually think of himself as a Nazi," said Joseph Killoran, an English professor at Armstrong State College. "But come on. Nazi symbols are not totally bereft of meaning. They still carry a very clear message, even if they're displayed under the guise of historic relics. The message is superiority. And don't think for a minute Jim Williams isn't aware of it. He's too smart not to be. In the South, among extreme chauvinists, you sometimes find a strange affinity for Nazi regalia. It has to do with a sense of once having been treated for what one was worth, and now being treated merely as an equal. There's a terribly social gentleman here in Savannah who sometimes wears Nazi uniforms to costume parties. Anyone can tell you who I'm talking about. He's known for it. And he says he does it for shock value, but the deeper meaning is still there. In Jim's case, it may not be anything more than apolitical arrogance. If a man lives in the grandest house in town and gives the most extravagant parties, he could easily come to believe he was superior. He might also think the rules for ordinary people no longer applied to him. Displaying a Nazi flag would be one way of demonstrating that. All in all, if a straw poll had been taken in Savannah in the first few weeks after the shooting, it would most likely have shown that the public expected the case to be dropped. By all appearances, the shooting had been self-defense, or at worst, a spur-of-the-moment crime of passion. Matters like these were traditionally settled quietly, especially when the accused was a highly respected, affluent individual with no criminal record. Savannians were well aware of past killings in which well-connected suspects were never charged, no matter how obvious their guilt. One of the more colorful stories involved a society spinster who claimed that her gentleman lover had shot himself with a rifle while sitting in a wing chair in her living room. The woman found her lover's body, cleaned the rifle, put it back in the rifle case, and then had the body embalmed. Only after having done all that did she call the police. "Oh, Jim Williams will probably get off," said Prentice Crow, a Savannah aristocrat. but he'll still face a few problems. There's bound to be a certain resentment about his having killed that boy. That boy in particular, I mean. Danny Hansford was a very accomplished hustler, from all accounts, very good at his trade, and very much appreciated by both men and women. The trouble is, he hadn't quite finished making the rounds. A fair number of men and women were looking forward to having their turn with him. Of course, now that Jim shot him, they never will. Naturally, they'll hold this against Jim, and that's what I mean when I say resentment. Danny Hansford was known to be a good time, but a good time not yet had by all. At the bar in the Oglethorpe Club, Sonny Clark put it more bluntly. You know what they're saying about Jim Williams, don't you? They're saying he shot the best piece of ass in Savannah. The entire city was captivated by the sensational shooting, and for weeks afterward, curious Savannians drove their cars into Monterey Square and circled around and around. Dog-eared copies of the September-October 1976 issue of Architectural Digest, the one with the feature on Mercer House, were passed from hand to hand. People who had never been inside the house came to know it as if they lived there. They could tell you that Danny Hansford had died midway between an oil painting attributed to the nephew of Thomas Gainsborough and a gold-encrusted desk that had been owned by Emperor Maximilian of Mexico. They could recite, with malicious glee, the now ironic concluding sentence of the article. The charm of the city and its way of life have found expression in Williams's careful and loving restoration of Mercer House, a house once ravaged by war and neglect, but now a center of harmony and quiet living. There was one major imponderable in the case against Jim Williams. Spencer Lawton, the new district attorney. Lawton was too new at the job to be predictable. Also, he owed a debt of gratitude to Lee Adler, whose support and beneficence had helped put him in office, and whose long-running feud with Jim Williams was well known. Lee Adler was uniquely positioned to influence the course of events, if he chose to do so. He could, in private conversation, encourage Lawton to prosecute Williams. Or, as seemed less likely, he could urge lenience. To people who were bold enough to ask if he was pressuring Lawton in any way, Adler stoutly replied, "Spencer Lawton is his own man." For more than a month after the shooting, Lawton kept a remarkably low profile. His name was never mentioned in press coverage of the case. All public statements from his office were made by his chief assistant. A preliminary hearing was set for June 17th, at which time Lawton would decide whether or not to seek an indictment. 5 days before the hearing was to take place, Lawton went before the Chatham County Grand Jury and presented his evidence in secret session. The grand jury acted quickly. It indicted Williams for first-degree murder, premeditated and with malice aforethought. The severity of the charge raised a few eyebrows. If there was to be an indictment at all, involuntary manslaughter had seemed a more likely charge than murder, given what was known of the case. Lawton would not discuss the evidence publicly, except to say that the lab tests had only been partially completed. Jim Williams would have to stand trial. A few days after the indictment, Danny Hansford's mother sued Williams for $10,003,500. She charged that he had killed Danny in an execution-style shooting. The $3,500 was for funeral expenses. Even now, Williams maintained an air of unruffled calm. His trial was not scheduled to begin until January, more than 6 months away. He asked the court for permission to go back to Europe on another buying trip, and permission was granted. When he returned, he kept to his old routines. He had his hair cut by Jimmy Taglioli on Abercorn Street. He shopped at Smith's Market. he ate dinner at Elizabeth on 37th. He was not even slightly remorseful. He had no reason to be, he thought. As he had told the Gazette, I haven't done anything wrong. Chapter 13. Checks and Balances.
Sometimes I think you Yankees only come down here to stir up trouble, said Joe Odom. I mean, look at Jim Williams, a model citizen, minds his own business, one success after another. Then you come along, and the next thing we know, he's killed somebody. I mean, really.
It was 3 in the morning. Joe was moving out of the house on Pulaski Square, exactly 6 months after having moved in. The unsuspecting real estate agent, John Thorson, was due back from England the next day, and Joe intended to restore the house to the condition in which Mr. Thorson had left it, locked and empty. Joe had found another house to move into on Lafayette Square, and now, in the dead of night, he dumped a last armload of clothes into the van parked out front.
All right, he said. So now we have a murder in a big mansion. God damn. Well, let's see where that puts us. We've got a weirdo bug specialist slinking around town with a bottle of deadly poison. We've got a nigger drag queen, an old man who walks an imaginary dog, and now a faggot murder case. My friend, you are getting me and Mandy into one hell of a movie.
Joe went back inside to search for telltale signs that he had been living there for 6 months. In the past half year, the supposedly unoccupied house had played host to a maelstrom of humanity. Over 1,000 tourists had traipsed through, peering into every nook and cranny and pausing to have a buffet lunch before leaving. At the same time, the never-ending parade of Joe's friends flowed in and out, with Jerry the hairdresser operating an all-but-full-time beauty salon in the kitchen. These diverse activities merged and mingled, sometimes with comical results. More than a few elderly ladies who came to the house for lunch got back on the tour bus with their hair completely restyled, and nearly everyone emerged clutching handbills advertising Sweet Georgia Browns. As always, new faces joined the cast of characters in Joe's entourage. Some hung on for a week or a month, others longer. As adroit as he was at gathering a crowd around him, Joe was utterly unable to cast anyone out. That task fell to an inner circle of friends who took it upon themselves to weed out unsavory hangers-on, with or without Joe's knowledge. In recent months, the primary target of this group had been a well-dressed man who had arrived in Savannah purporting to be a Palm Beach millionaire. In actual fact, he was a small-time entrepreneur who had opened a whorehouse on the road to Tybee. Before anyone knew it, he was quietly soliciting business from the men in the tour groups at Joe's. The inner circle called on a retired policeman, Sarge Bolton, to get rid of him. One glimpse of the revolver in Sarge's shoulder holster, and the man was gone. Joe's friends had nothing against whorehouses, but they were worried that this one might complicate matters for Joe, who was just now coming under the scrutiny of the authorities because of the bad checks he had written before the opening of Sweet Georgia Browns. The checks had begun to arrive at the prosecutor's office on the average of 1 a week. The carpenter's check, the electrician's check, the plumber's check for the antique merry-go-round horse on top of the bar. When the total reached $18,000, two sheriff's deputies came to Sweet Georgia Brown's and served Joe with a summons. He was directed to appear for a hearing in court. Depending on the outcome of the hearing, he might or might not be indicted for writing worthless checks, a felony punishable by 1 to 5 years in prison. On the day of the hearing, Joe strolled calmly into the courtroom, 20 minutes late. Before taking his seat, he ambled over to the bench where the plaintiffs were sitting and greeted each of them.
Howdy, George, he said to the carpenter. The carpenter managed a wan smile. Hey, Joe, he said. Joe moved on to the electrician, the plumber, the general contractor, the man from the linen supply, and on down the line.
Howdy.
Afternoon.
Hello.
He spoke without a hint of sarcasm or irony. His voice was cheerful. His eyes were bright, his smile broad and easy. It was almost as if he were greeting patrons at Sweet Georgia Brown's. Joe's affability contrasted with the discomfiture of the men on the bench. Their embarrassed, almost sheepish expressions made them seem more like the accused than the aggrieved, as if by being there they had been caught in an act of disloyalty against their genial friend. They smiled meekly and mumbled hellos. At the end of the row, Joe came to a tiny, sparrow-like man with silver hair and bushy black eyebrows. It was an antiques dealer from Charleston who had sold him the merry-go-round horse and other pieces of furniture. Joe brightened.
"Why, Mr. Russell," he said, "what a surprise! I didn't know you were coming."
Mr. Russell shifted nervously in his seat. "Believe me, Joe, I would rather not have come. I really hate this, but, you know,
Oh, that's all right," said Joe. "I can't say I blame you. It's just that if I'd known you were coming, I'd have asked you to bring that pair of sconces I liked so much."
"Oh, did you?" the man said.
Did we...
Mr. Russell blinked, as if trying to clear his head.
"Oh, now I remember," he said. "We did talk about those sconces, didn't we? You're right. I'd forgotten all about that. Well, now that you mention it, Joe, I guess I could have brought them with me."
"Well, don't worry about it," said Joe. "We can discuss it later." He walked over and took his seat alone at the defense table. The hearing judge gaveled the room to order.
"Mr. Odom, are you being represented by counsel?"
"Your Honor," said Joe, "as a member in good standing of the State Bar of Georgia, I'll be representing myself."
The judge nodded.
"Well, then, let's proceed."
An assistant prosecutor read off the list of Joe's bad checks. Then, one by one, the plaintiffs took the stand and described the work they had done or the goods they had supplied and how, no matter how often they tried to cash Joe's checks, they always bounced. When Mr. Russell took the stand, the prosecutor and the judge conferred at the bench for several minutes, riffling through papers. The judge then rapped his gavel and informed Mr. Russell that, in filing his complaint, he hadn't followed the proper procedure. Therefore, his claim would be disallowed, at least for the time being. This would reduce the bad check charges against Joe by the sum of $4,200. A red-faced Mr. Russell came down from the stand and took his seat.
"Your Honor," said Joe, "with your permission, I'd like to have a word with Mr. Russell."
"No objection," the judge replied.
Joe motioned for the antiques dealer to come over and sit next to him. He took the man's file and spread the papers on the table. Then, while the courtroom looked on, Joe read through the papers, speaking to Mr. Russell in a quiet, confidential tone. After a few minutes, he looked up at the judge.
"Your Honor," he said, "if you will allow me, I think we can remedy this situation in 20 minutes or so, and once we've done that, you can reinstate Mr. Russell's claim against me."
The judge looked warily at Joe, uncertain whether he was merely having a laugh at the court's expense or whether he might actually be slipping a fast one by him.
"The court appreciates your offer," the judge said, "but I doubt if there's any precedent for a defendant acting as counsel for the plaintiff. One could worry that counsel might place his own best interests ahead of those of his client, if you see my point." "I do, Your Honor," said Joe,
but in this case it's really just a matter of filling out forms. This gentleman has come all the way from Charleston.